Good morning. As Patrick has already said, I'm Kevin Gladding. I'm not the pastor of this church, but I am a pastoral intern here by the grace of God and the session at Christ the King Presbyterian Church. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to bring God's word to you this morning. I don't know if you remember this story, but back in May of 2013, a tugboat capsized off the coast of Nigeria. 12 hands were on deck. Nobody surfaced. For 60 hours, or 2.5 days, they struggled to get a crew out there to check the ship. As you might imagine, after 2.5 days worth of nobody surfacing, they presumed everyone to be dead. And if you're not claustrophobic, and you can stomach a little bit of shock, you can look up the video and see the divers go through the ship to look for those who had drowned in this tragedy. But what you'll also see is that in the midst of their search for the bodies that they were trying to recover, one of the divers sees a hand dangling in the water and reaches to grab it, and the hand grabs him back. You might imagine that would have been the most terrifying experience of that man's life. But the incredible thing about this story is that Harrison Okene was a man who had worked on the ship as a cook. He had no obvious idea that this might very well be his last journey on this tugboat. And he had received a text message from his wife prior to beginning this journey. And when in an interview, they asked him, "What did you do for 60 hours as you sat there in this one air pocket that lasted you until somebody found you?" And he said, I quoted what my wife had sent to me. And what she had sent to him was this: "Oh God, by your name, save me. The Lord sustains my life." It's a section from Psalm 54. I don't know what Harrison Okene's familiarity with that psalm was prior to this point in his life, but I think it is not too much to say that he sings it now differently than he did before. And for the last 2 weeks, Christ the King has been looking through the Psalms to reclaim and rediscover what it looks like for us to sing these songs ourselves, to pray these words, to form and to forge and to deepen our prayers. We looked at Psalm 8 and answered the cosmic question, "What is man that you are mindful of him?" and saw that what we need is a reawakening of our awe. We looked at Psalm 19 and looked at the cosmos itself by looking up and down and in and recognized the need to revitalize our reveling in God's revelation. Psalm 23 this morning comes to us as a different type of psalm. It's a psalm of trust, a psalm of confidence, and it is very, very personal. It's a psalm that we know. I imagine most of you in this room could quote it. It's a psalm that we put on cards and hang on our refrigerators with magnets. It's a psalm that we do at funerals. But I want us to consider this morning, is it a psalm that we sing? Is this a psalm that we can look at one another and pray in honesty and integrity, from the gut, if you will? And if it's not, what's it going to take for us to start to recognize the truth and the beauty and the power in these words and to be able to say them with and to one another as a proclamation of the people of God? That's the question that I want us to consider this morning. If you look at the front of your bulletin, you see a quote there from Maya Angelou underneath the picture from Pilgrim's Progress. And she says that courage is the most important of all the virtues, because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. I want to suggest to you that's what it's going to take for us to sing this psalm is courage. But that courage is not going to come until we start to reawaken our awareness. And so rise with me this morning, hear the word of the Lord, and then let us examine what it is exactly we need to be aware of. Psalm 23, a psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Please be seated. When I read this psalm, as I have now for a couple of weeks, I really have only got one reaction initially, and it's just the word wow. It's not deep and it's not theological, but I think it's appropriate because this psalm overwhelms me, if I'm going to be honest with you. This psalm overwhelms me with what it says, with what it implies, with what it asks of me. And then it's immediately followed by the rhyming question, how? How am I going to sing this? If the commentators are right, then this psalm perhaps was composed or at least sung by David during the time of Absalom's rebellion. It strikes me as a little bit odd, because when I think about the fact that David's son had spurned him and led his own people against him and sent him scurrying away in defeat to be reviled by those who were once his subjects, and then I think about writing the words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," seems a little bit like a disjunction to me. And yet, I would suggest to you that just like with Harrison O'Kene, just like with David during these times, it is exactly these times that reawaken in the hearts of God's people the reality of who He is, of who they are, and what He's doing. And so I would suggest to you that in order to pray these, the courage that we need to say these words together is going to come from a trifecta here, or a triplet of awareness. An awareness of character, an awareness of comfort, and an awareness of communion. Character, comfort, and communion. So the first point this morning is this. In order to sing this song, we have to be aware of the shepherd's revealed character. This is the first part. This is how the psalm begins. You want to know where the courage to sing this comes from? It comes from these words, "Yahweh is my shepherd." This is where David gets it. He doesn't start by saying, "I shall not want." He doesn't start with a proclamation of his identity. He starts with a proclamation of God's identity. If you've never heard this before, the word "Lord" in this passage is in what they call small caps, but all caps, in order to differentiate it, because this is the name Yahweh in Hebrew. This is the covenant-making and the covenant-keeping God. This is the God who resides and reigns sovereignly, the God whose eyes range over the whole of the earth to see who is upright that He might support them. This is the God that David is speaking to. In order to sing the words of this psalm, David first recognizes that the shepherd has revealed his character to him. And so David names him the Lord, Yahweh. But he doesn't stop there, because in addition to providing a name, we also have a job description, in a sense. We have this Lord's job title. He's a shepherd. This is what he does. The nature of who he is now moves into the nature of what he does, and what the shepherd does is provide. The primary tasks of any good shepherd are to feed and to protect. And if you look at the language of the psalm as it opens up, that's exactly what God does. So this is not just the shepherd who is transcendent. This is not just Yahweh who reigns sovereignly and is distant. This is also the intimate and imminent shepherd. This is the one who is near, the one that David can say, "I'm not the only sheep, but I know you well enough to know that you know who I am." And so David can say, "The Lord is my shepherd." Not a shepherd, not just the shepherd, but my shepherd. It's personal. And so we see the shepherd's character is revealed in that David doesn't lack. He says, "I shall not want. I shall not lack. There is nothing that I'm going to need outside of what you give to me." This is what David says, because we see early on that the shepherd is provisional. We also see that the shepherd is protective. It's not just to grass and to waters that God leads David, but it is to still waters. It is to green grass. It is, in fact, to the places that are not only going to sustain him, but sustain him well. The waters are not the turbulent and full and swollen waters of a river that is too fast for the sheep to drink from. They're also not the still and stagnant waters that are going to make the sheep sick. They're waters of rest. And so the language of this reveals to us that the shepherd is provisional, that he is protective, and also that he's proactive. Because it's God who's leading. The shepherd doesn't show the sheep a map and then say, "You've got to get here. Good luck." Not much of a shepherd if he did that, and he wouldn't be a shepherd if he did that. He's got to lead. And so David says in verse 3, "He leads me in paths of righteousness." This is the shepherd's responsibility. And if you look further into verse 3, what you're going to find is that the shepherd's reputation is tied to what he does for the sheep. "He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake." In other words, if he's going to call himself a shepherd, but he loses all his sheep, he's not going to be a shepherd for very long. And no one's going to trust him as one. But what David says here is, no, your name, the holiness, the righteousness, the perfection of your name is important enough and high enough and powerful enough that you will not let your sheep go. This is what David becomes aware of. To sing this song, we've got to be aware that the shepherd can do what he says he can do because he's powerful enough. The shepherd can do what he says he's going to do because he knows enough about his sheep and about the path. And the shepherd can do what he promises to do because he's gracious enough to see it done. He's the leader and guide, protector and provider, the restorer and rest giver. The question then is for us, what do we do with that? Because as Patrick has already said this morning, we're sheep. The reality is, if we're going to apply the awareness that God is shepherd, then we also have to simultaneously admit to ourselves that we're sheep. And that's not easy. It's not for me. And I would assume that for many of you, you struggle with the same. In the movie Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams is a new English poetry literary professor at this fairly prestigious school. And he comes in and basically introduces himself and tells them, "You may call me Mr. Keating, or you may call me, O Captain, my Captain," taking the title from Walt Whitman. And there is, as there was here, a ripple of laughter around the room, because there's no way. It's not going to happen. We don't know you. There's no reason for us to trust you. But by the end of the movie, through trial and triumph, through his revelation of his care for them, not just their understanding of the subject matter, but as human beings, by the end of the movie, every single student that is left stands up on the desk and says, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." And I wonder if maybe this is what we need to do with this psalm, to be willing to say, "Oh, Shepherd, my Shepherd." And in saying that, to understand that we are not the shepherd. Charles Spurgeon has said that no man can say, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," until he has given up every idle notion that he can control himself or manage his own interests. David doesn't say, "I'm king, I shall not want." David doesn't say, "The nations bring me tribute, I shall not want." He says, "Yahweh is my shepherd. And that's the only reason that I shall not want." He's aware that the answer to Abraham's question, "Will not the judge of all the earth do right?" is yes. He will. He's aware that the shepherd is going to keep his covenantal promises. He's aware of what we've already quoted together from the Psalm of Asaph and Psalm 73, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing that I desire on earth apart from you. God is my portion forever." It may not be the future that he wanted. I'm quite certain that if this was written during the time of Absalom's rebellion, it was not the future that he wanted. It wasn't the one he was trying to build. And yet, the shepherd is the one who is still with him, still proactively leading, still giving, still guiding. And so David can say, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." I will not cheapen your struggle. I understand the tension here. I experience this tension with you. There is a mystery in this. But I want to say that the mystery has got to be resolved in the fact that whatever God has given you is not without purpose and not outside His plan. Tim Keller has said that if you take Romans 8:28 and paraphrase it, Romans 8:28, of course, being the passage that says all things work for good to those who love God and are called according to His purposes. He says, if you paraphrase that, you might be able to say something like this: whatever God has given me is exactly what I would have asked for if I knew everything He knows. Whatever God has given me is exactly what I would have asked for if He knew everything He knows. For you parents in the room, you understand at least some of this because you can see further than your children can. And they'll ask you for things that you know aren't good for them. They think they are. I still think things are good for me that my parents deny me. And I'm in my 30s. But this is what David recognizes. So then the question that we have to deal with is this: who are we going to listen to? The witless sheep? Because let's face it, sheep aren't bright. Or the watchful shepherd? For as long as we are attempting to shepherd ourselves or to allow ourselves to be steered away by another shepherd, we're going to experience want. Because we're going to experience only those things that will leave us ultimately unsatisfied. But if we can say with David, if we can screw up our courage to say with David, "The Lord is my shepherd," then we can also understand what it means, "I shall not want." Unless we understand the shepherd's character, we will misunderstand the nature of want, and we will also misplace the source of our comfort. And that's the second point this morning. If we're going to sing this song, we've got to be aware of the real source of our comfort. The verses 1 through 3 are beautiful, and they're difficult. But if we took out the latter half of verse 1, then we might be able to come up with something that at least made us feel good. But the psalm doesn't end there. And there's a reason for that. Because as Patrick said last week, David is not really into the whole pie in the sky thinking. This is not a wishful hoping. This is not a everything is peachy keen type of psalm, because that wouldn't be an honest psalm. David says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." This is where the psalm moves. This is the second stanza of the song, if you will. The movement of the psalm has gone to a recognition of the awareness of the character of God that provides and protects and proactively leads, and now moves into this, and we end up in the valley of the shadow of death. It's a little odd. A little out of place, perhaps. I think a lot of us recognize this psalm, and we're so familiar with it that we forget just how jarring this is. We had pastures, and we had water, and we had a God who was letting us lie down so that if we woke up, we had food beneath us and food in front of us. This was good stuff. How did we get into the valley? What's going on here? Because as Doug Green comments, at the very least, the valley is a place that threatens harm and engenders fear. The description that the psalmist is facing embodies all that stands diametrically opposed to the fresh green pastures and tranquil waters. Let's not sugarcoat the valley. I think sometimes we try to explain the valley away. Maybe try to talk about the valley as though it's not really that bad. It is. David calls it the valley of the shadow of death, or another translation, the valley of deep darkness, for a reason. David never says there is no evil in the valley. David never says there's nothing to fear in the valley. David says, "I will not fear." And there's an enormous difference between those ideas. As one commentator said, "This darkness is as of Hades, and more especially of darkness such as makes itself felt in wild, uninhabited desert." We ask ourselves, what happened to the grass? What happened to the water? And I think the reason we ask ourselves those questions is because we forget two things about the grass and the water. Number one, it was never permanent. Grass withers, waters dry up. Number two, it was never final. The pastures were good, and the shepherd brought us to what was good, but it was never our final place to be. Which means that there's got to be some place we're journeying to. So if we end up in this valley of the shadow of death, why is David able to say, I will fear no evil? It's simply this. He says, you're with me. For you are with me. This is a declaration of confidence in the fact that what he has always come from the shepherd. The grass wasn't his to begin with, and neither was the water. And so David lets us understand, maybe for the first time, that verse 4 has to be read in the context of verse 3. We can't abstract verse 4 out and use it like we often do to read at funerals and to try to give ourselves a little bit of comfort in dark times. Honestly, it's not all that comforting abstracted from the rest of the psalm. But when you read verse 4 in the context of what has come before, what you see is this. He restores my soul. The shepherd is not going to lead you into the valley of the shadow of death, having given you back life only to see you die again. It's not what he does. Verse 3 goes on to say, he leads me in paths of righteousness, or maybe contextually in this sense, better translated, right paths. In other words, it's the shepherd who led you into the valley. There's really no way around that. But David doesn't ask why that is. David understands that the valley is part of the journey, that the valley is actually part of the right paths. That if you stayed forever in the pastures and the water, it wouldn't be good for you. And the reality is they weren't going to last forever anyway. So let's get up and go and get to where God is taking us. David understands this. He leads me in right paths. John Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress, if you read the part where Christian is in the valley of the shadow of death, you'll see that Bunyan understood this. The valley of the shadow of death was on the path. Christian had wandered off the path at other moments and found himself into some places he shouldn't have been, but this wasn't one of them. This was actually a part of the place he was supposed to be. And yet, in the midst of all of this, David says, I shall not fear because the shepherd is here. Guys, if the shepherd is there and we're not supposed to be there, then either he's insane or he's lost. And we've already discussed the character of the shepherd. Neither one of those are true. God is not some maniacal, vengeful being who is just waiting for you to enter that valley. He's leading you through that valley. You've got somewhere else to be, but it's got to pass through this valley. David's words are not the words of somebody who has passed on, but the words of somebody who is passing through. And so I would suggest to you that though we often use this passage at funerals, this is as much and more so a passage for the living as it is for the dead. The shepherd has not lost his sheep, but death has lost its sting. You see, what's going on here is that all of the terrors of the valley, all the things the valley holds, all the unpredictable dangers, the bandits that lie in wait, the predators that stalk looking for the one easy meal they can find, all of those things are relegated to shadows. This is not the valley of death for the people of God. This is the valley of the shadow of death. It doesn't mean there are no dangers. But it does take the edge a little bit. And it reminds us that the source of our comfort was never the things that God had given to us anyway. It was always God himself. This is what Asaph is getting at when he says, God is my portion forever. Because as Patrick said, the psalm is really, it starts off rocky. Asaph is basically admitting his own discontent with looking around him and seeing others as being, quote, better off than he himself is. And then he comes to Psalm 73 in verse 25 and 6, and he recognizes, God has always been my portion. This has always been what this is about. All of the other things may be good. They may be nice. They may be even helpful at times, but they're not the source of comfort. We need to be careful about mistaking the things that bring us comfort for the source of comfort itself. If God's word is true and we claim to believe it, then we must also believe that every good and perfect thing comes down from the Father of lights who reigns in heaven. This shepherd carries the rod and the staff, instruments of direction and protection. The staff is that which, if you will, steers the sheep back to the path, that which grabs the sheep if they wander too far, only further supporting the fact that the shepherd is bringing you back to the path you're actually supposed to be on. The valley of the shadow of death is not a path you wandered into. But the rod, that's for protection. That is the implement with which the shepherd will beat down the attackers that come for the sheep. It is the implement that will stave off, and even the sight of it will ward off those things that may have thought, I can get those sheep. And the word rod there is also carries the connotation with it of the idea of scepter. In other words, David can say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and I shall fear no evil, because God reigns. Because just like he wrote in Psalm 11, the Lord is in his holy temple, the Lord's throne is in heaven. He's overseeing. He's watching. He's not far off. He's near enough to hear the sheep. This is how David can descend into the valley without questioning why. A couple of commentators have noted that David is either aware of the purpose of the descent, or he is utterly impressed by God's faithfulness, and that's why he doesn't ask. And I would suggest to you that it's both. But the reality is, his faith in who the shepherd is makes him aware that there is a purpose larger than perhaps what David can fully comprehend. And the fact that David is beginning to comprehend this purpose only undergirds the faith that David has in the shepherd. David knows that he doesn't just have a shepherd. He belongs to the shepherd. And the shepherd, as one pastor has said, has loved him too long and too dearly to ever let him go. I would ask us this morning to consider, where do we find the source of our comfort? What is it in our lives that we know, we won't admit out loud maybe, but we know inside that if it were stripped from us, it would devastate us? Because David, in the time of Absalom's rebellion at least, had been stripped most things, and yet is still crying out, even in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Even in the valley of the shadow of death, I am aware that the sheep's true comfort is and always has been and always will be my God. It is the presence of the shepherd, the reality of his nearness, that is the sheep's true comfort. I don't know what your comforts are, what those things are that maybe grab you and maybe cause you to stray from the shepherd or cause you some ideas that this might be better than that. But I would encourage you to get rid of the notion that God is keeping good from you. That is the temptation that Satan used in the garden, is it not? That somehow there was just something that God was keeping back that she really should have been able to have. And I would ask you to consider this morning that maybe God knows what he's doing. The final stage of the journey has yet to be reached. That appears to us in verses 5 and 6. And the last thing I want to say to you this morning is this. If we're going to sing this song, if we're going to get the courage to sing this song, we're going to be required to be aware of the shepherd's rich communion. Look at verse 5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Here we see that David's understanding, that his awareness not only of the shepherd's presence, but of the shepherd's provision. That God isn't just with him, God has gone before him. That God has now changed, if you will, David has changed the metaphor. It's not just a shepherd anymore, it's a shepherd host. It's one who has prepared bounty. It's one who has laid a table out so that David may commune and feast and sup with the one he has been following. This is the end point of the journey. The green pastures were good. The still waters were good. But this is what it's about. Communion with his God in the house of his God. This is where the entire journey of the psalm has been leading to. It's been building up to this. And so verses 5 and 6 really trump verse 1. Verse 1 and 2 were good. Those were good things, but verses 5 and 6 are better. Now it's not just you have what you need, but now it's lavish to the point of excess. My cup overflows. This is a prodigality of love, as one pastor says. The grass and the water give way to the banquet table and the cup of wine. It's a beautiful image, and it reminds us that what we're about and what we're ultimately after is communion with our God. And amazingly, this happens in the presence of his enemies. And this has caused a lot of commentaries to disagree, and there have been a lot of interpretations of what this means. I'm going to give you the two that I think were the most common and the two that I like best. The first is that either the enemies have been vanquished and are unable to assail the feast, or, in line with the idea of communion, the enemies are at the feast because God is in the business of turning enemies into friends. This goes beyond merely understanding who he is to experiencing who he is. David would not want in the opening verse because the shepherd provided. He would not fear in the following section because the shepherd was with him. But here, the intimacy only increases. We're still using the personal you that we were using in verse 3. But now we see, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. The word surely is an exclusionary word. It's an emphatic word. It can be translated only. And the word follow is a word that literally entails or encompasses the idea of pursuit. So it's not just that there's going to be some good things that follow along after you. And maybe some of them catch up and maybe some of them don't. This is the idea that only goodness and mercy are going to be the things pursuing you. This is what David says. To commune in the house of the Lord is to receive from his riches, from the bounty of his goodness, and ultimately to do so not only in communion with the host, but with the host of his servants. The psalm that started so personally, so intimately, ends literally in corporeality. It ends in the idea of the corporate. David is going to be in the house of God. What's in the house of God? Servants of God. And so David ends by saying, "And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." As one commentary mentions, the personal assurance articulated by the psalmist is finally experienced in the community of God's people. It's interesting to note that if you read through the entirety of Psalm 73, you'll see that Asaph's burden of discontentment falls away only at the point that he says, "I entered the sanctuary of my God." That's the turning point for Asaph. For David, it's the final destination point, the recognition that this is where I long to be, it's where I belong, and it's ultimately where the shepherd is leading. And so by way of application this morning, beloved, I would parrot what Patrick said last week. Take up and read. And then take up and sing. I've already mentioned to you that in order to sing this psalm, we need courage that comes from three different types of awareness. But I would also say to you that in order to gain that awareness, you need to start singing the psalm. Sing it. Sing it until you believe it. And then find somebody else to sing it with. And recognize that as personal as this psalm is and always will be a song for the people of God. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen.